have a couple of groups that are gone today. One on the road right now, I think. Our young people going to camp in Arkansas. Isn't that right? Let's keep them in our prayers. Also, we have a group that left yesterday going to Peru. Do I assume that they have arrived safely? Anyone know? Yes? Good. So let's keep them in our prayers, as well as Tyrone Minear, who is in the Sudan in a potentially dangerous situation. Let's keep all those folks, part of our family here, that are away from us in our prayers, particularly this week. We're in a series of lessons I began last Sunday that I'm entitling Moral Issues of Our Day. And the lesson for today, I've tried and tried and tried to cut it to fit into the time frame. I cannot, so I'm going to continue it tonight. So come back tonight for the second part of the lesson that will begin this morning. I want to begin with a story. The little town of Cahul, Guatemala, like many other Latin American countries, reenacts the crucifixion of Jesus every Lent. Thousands of pilgrims follow a hallowed procession to the whitewashed Catholic church carrying a larger-than-life statue of Jesus, who implores heaven and staggers under the weight of his cross. One day in the autumn of 1979, another anguished crowd gathered in the town square imploring heaven. They had been summoned to an execution. Arrested by the army, a group of 23 local guerrillas had been tortured and were now to be executed publicly. The populace was ordered to witness the spectacle. Among the victims was a 16-year-old boy, Petrosinio Menchu, whose family, alerted to his plight, hurried 25 kilometers overnight to be present at his execution. Soldiers dragged Petrosinio and the other prisoners off the army truck, commanded them to hold themselves in a straight line. Most of them could barely stand at all. Their tortures over several weeks had been brutal, leaving them bloated like bladders. Petrosinio had no fingernails left. The soles of his feet had been beaten to a pulp. His wounds were oozing with infection. Methodically, the soldiers took scissors and cut off the prisoner's clothes. They then callously explained how each wound had been inflicted on the tortured bodies. Finally, the commanding officer ordered his men to soak the prisoners in gasoline and set them on fire. The victims died hideously, writhing on the ground, the crowd watching horrified, enraged, but helpless. This gruesome description comes at the climax of a book by Petrosinio's 23-year-old sister, Rigoberta Menchu, published in 1983. It was reprinted endlessly in magazines and recounted dramatically in conferences, based on 18 and a half hours of taped interview given by Rigoberta Menchu to anthropologist Elizabeth Burgos in Paris. The book propelled the Mayan to international fame and acclaim, including 14 honorary doctorates, welcoming receptions from Pope John Paul II, many heads of state, awards such as France's Legion of Honor, and the climax of it all, the Nobel Peace Prize for 1992. There was only one small problem. An anthropology professor at Middlebury College, Vermont, investigated, confirmed by the New York Times, found that her story contained, among other things, huge factual discrepancies and political distortions. Her claims were not true. No one had been burned alive in the plaza of Cahul. Professor Stoll's charges create a firestorm of outrage and indignation. His charges were sacrilege. Explanations and excuses for Menchu were showered down on him. All memories are selective, especially those of victims of trauma. All testimonies are both tailored and exaggerated. It's absurd to hold illiterate people to Western standards of journalistic accuracy. And anyway, Wasn't Minchu speaking for her larger truth, for all the Guatemalan people and not just for herself? A Spanish professor at Wesley College defended Minchu. Whether her book is true or not, I don't care. We should teach our students about the brutality of the Guatemalan military and the U.S. financing of it. Minchu herself dismissed Stoll's obsession with facts as racism. Whites have been writing our history for over 500 years, and no white anthropologist is going to tell me what I experienced in my own flesh. As she told the Washington Post, my truth is that my brother was burned alive. The watershed issue for every human being and every society is how we handle truth. That's not a psychological or a sociological statement. Jesus taught me that. He said to Pilate, "For this reason I was born, and for this reason I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to me." John 18:37. These words divide humankind into two camps, two groups, two different worlds. Those who place high value on truth and those who don't. Pilate was the consummate politician. He had already lost two confrontations with Jewish leaders. They had faced him and stood him down. When he put golden eagles, the Roman golden eagles, on the city gates, they protested, and he finally took them down. He installed Roman standards on the temple grounds. They protested. He threatened to kill them all, and they exposed their necks to him and said, in essence, "Go ahead." He couldn't, and so he removed the Roman standards. He had made a serious political blunder executing some Galileans in Luke chapter 13, verse 1 and 2, which had made him an enemy of Herod Antipas, the governor of Galilee. And now Jesus was standing before him, and he was in a bind. He was intimidated. He was afraid. He wanted to do what he knew was right, release Jesus, but the people were demanding that he crucify him. A politician's moral dilemma. There would be serious consequences if he released him. And so he arrogantly shot back, "What does is mean?" Now, I know I just went over some of the younger folks' head, but ask somebody who's older. That's not really what he said, but it is really what he said. The words that he said was, "What is truth?" And he walked out. I know of no other incident which so clearly defines and illustrates the single fundamental watershed principle which determines morality, individually and collectively, as what is truth. This may be difficult for us to accept, but in order to understand how such a change has taken place in our country's mentality, we need to understand a basic change that has occurred in people's concept of what truth is. Let me illustrate the change. Sherry was discussing with her mom her upcoming visit home from college, and she was telling her about her new boyfriend, Tony. "You'll love him, Mom," Sherry declared. "He's so sweet. Not to mention brilliant, he's already excelling in every class. Everyone respects him, and he treats me like a queen." Her mom smiled. "I'm so happy for you. So when do we get to meet him?" "Actually, we were hoping we could both come home for Christmas break. Not for the entire 2 weeks, of course. We want to spend part of it with his parents, too. But at least long enough that you can all get to know each other." "That's wonderful, honey. Your dad and I would just love it. Let us know ahead of time which days you'll be here, and I'll have the guest room ready." Sherry hesitated. Sure, Mom. Although, and she took a deep breath, well, like, is the guest room really necessary? I was thinking we could just stay in my room together. Her mom's surprised voice said, don't be silly. You can't do that. It wouldn't be right. I thought you'd say that, Sherry responded. I explained to Tony how you and Dad feel about that sort of thing, but I promised to talk to you about it anyway. But don't worry, we'll respect your feelings and sleep in separate rooms while we're here. Her mom's heart pounded. While you're here? What do you mean, while you're here? Are you trying to tell me that you intend to sleep together when you're not here? We already do, Mom. We're in love. You don't really expect us to, her mom interrupted. I expect you to respect the morals and values we've taught you all your life. I do. That's why I agreed that we would sleep in separate rooms while we're here, but at Tony's house and at school, it's different. Her mom shook her head. Are you trying to tell me that Tony's parents have no problem with your sleeping together at their house? No, Mom, they don't. After all, not everyone shares your views on that sort of thing, you know. I know that, but I certainly thought you did. Sherry responded, Mom, in many ways I do share your views. You and Dad have taught me a lot, but there are some things I have to decide for myself. For you and Dad, living together before you got married would have been wrong, but I don't feel the same way. That's what I wish you could understand. You have your value system and I have mine. The fact that they're different doesn't mean one is right and one is wrong. And it doesn't mean we can't respect each other's opinions. In fact, that's the whole point. We need to respect and honor differing value systems. Yours, mine, and everyone else's. Just as we honor and respect our own. Anything else would be intolerant. We can't force our values, our beliefs, on other people. It's just not right. Can't you please try to understand that? You caught it, right? We need to respect and honor differing value systems, yours, mine, and everyone else's, just as we honor our own. We can't force our values, our beliefs, on other people. Folks, that's the Trojan horse. That's the elephant in the room. There is no one single truth for everyone. You have yours. I have mine. They're equally true. They're equally right. And you have an obligation to honor each one as such. That will sell. It is selling. And it's being bought wholesale. Wrap it up, put music to it, and it sounds like there ain't no good guys, there ain't no bad guys, there's just you and me, and we just disagree. Put it in a package, put it on TV, and it looks like a sitcom. And if I were watching them today, I could name them. I don't know really what all they are. I got on my computer and looked up a few of them, Jersey Shore, Family Guy, South Park, Simpsons, Friends, Will and Grace. That's what it looked like. How many of us are entertained by those things? There was a debate some time back on the topic of the role of religion in government. And Alan Keyes was on one side, and a law professor at an unnamed Ivy League school was on the other, Dershowitz. This debate reflects the principles that we're examining in these lessons regarding the new tolerance in postmodernism. Dershowitz, when asked by the panel how he knew what truth was, responded, he did not know what truth was. He knew what was wrong. And he listed injustices and inhumanities and atrocities that had been committed. And he concluded, I do not know what truth is, nor do I ever expect to know, but I will die trying to discover it. And he added, I know that many of you think you know what truth is, but you're wrong. You don't know. When you have a decision to make, you will base it on one of two foundations: a principle of right and truth, or your feelings. One of those two. In John 17:17, in Jesus' prayer, he prayed to the Father, "Sanctify them," talking about those who would be his followers, "by your truth, for your word is truth." A few weeks ago, Nathan Ingram, in a class on fear, used an illustration that I'd like to lift and borrow. And it illustrates the evolutionary attitudes toward truth. And three baseball umpires are debating their different philosophies of umpiring. The first one says, "There's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way they are." The second one says, "No, that's arrogant. There's balls and there's strikes, and I call them the way I see it." And the third one said, "That's no better. Why beat around the bush? Why not be realistic about what we do? There's pitches, and they ain't nothing till I call them." The first umpire represents the traditional views of truth, objective, independent to the mind of the knower, and there to be discovered. The second umpire represents moderate relativism. It's more subjective, subject to variations of individual perspective. Sociologists call it modernism. In the 60s, we called it situation ethics. The third umpire represents radical relativism. The truth is, there is no truth. Each person is free to create their own truth. Sociologists call that postmodernism. In our postmodern world, the question no longer is it true? But rather, whose truth is it? Our world becomes characterized by the attitude expressed by Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda minister, when he said, "We do not talk to say something, but to obtain a certain effect." Let it soak in, folks. We do not talk to say something, but to obtain a certain effect. And in the process, truth is manipulated and sacrificed. So we're adrift. In a world in which truth is dying, rules are designated only to break them for our entertainment. Rules are meant to be broken, right? We live in a world where all cats are gray. Now, if you're struggling today to understand why it is that in the last decade that Christians and Christianity have fallen under such duress in our society, you're going to have to come back tonight, because it plugs in right here. And Lord willing, we're going to plug it in. But I want to impress on you with this series of lessons the importance of how you handle truth. And that means in every walk of life. It even means in such things that we consider to be almost frivolous. Things when we pass along an email because of the effect rather than because it's true. And sometimes, even when we know it's not true, we pass along something as if it is true because it has its desired effect. Now, you tell me how different that is than what Goebbels said: "We do not talk to say something, but to obtain a certain effect." Truth is a precious, precious thing. It's not fragile, but it can be manipulated. And people in societies have and do. And the consequences are devastating. They're devastating to you as an individual. They're devastating to your children who observe how you handle truth and how important it is to you. And it's devastating to a nation and to a world. You'll know the truth and the truth will make you free. But when you pass off a falsehood as if it's true, it will put you in shackles forever. Let's stand and sing.
For Christ.